I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the outbreak of Ebola continues to get worse. Over 1,500 deaths have been documented in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the deadly virus is threatening to spread to neighboring nations. The United States has pulled out of the World Health Organization, reducing the global response to the outbreak. We'll have the latest. And later on The Source, federal HIV prevention funding is facing deep cuts. Public health leaders are warning that access to outreach, testing, and other prevention services are at risk. What does this look like for AIDS prevention efforts in San Antonio and across the region? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. An Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is rapidly becoming one of the world's most serious public health emergencies. Over 1,500 deaths have been recorded. The outbreak involves a strain of the Ebola virus for which there is no vaccine or proven treatment. Containing the virus has been made harder by armed conflicts, mass displacement, delayed testing, shortage of healthcare workers, and a deep public distrust. The crisis is also raising questions about sweeping U.S. cuts to foreign aid and global health programs. With cases spreading across the eastern Congo, how much worse could this become? Joining us is Rodney Rohde, a professor and chair of the Medical Laboratory Science at Texas State University. And Rodney Rohde, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much, David. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Susan McLennan. She is an infectious disease specialist at UTMB and medical director of its biocontainment treatment unit. And Dr. McLennan, welcome to The Source.
Hi, very happy to be here. Thank you.
Rodney Rohde, can you tell me about Ebola? What is Ebola? Why is this so severe?
Yeah, so Ebola, many people have probably seen this in the headlines of the news over the past decade or so, is a really different type of virus. It's called a filovirus. It's an RNA-based virus. And typically we see this in the African continent. Many people might remember it showed up on our shores in 2014 during an outbreak in Africa, and some of our medical workers ended up back in the U.S., which were eventually taken care of, and they were fine. But it is somewhat of a virus that does invoke fear, especially in people that don't know a lot about it. It's called a hemorrhagic fever virus, so it is usually something that's going to impact the systems of our body that allow us to coagulate blood. And so when you get this virus, you start out sometimes not really knowing what's going on in those regions, because it can present as malaria or something like that. But ultimately, Ebola causes you to bleed out. And by bleeding out, I mean it truly bleeds out in almost all sorts of orifices in the body. It's been the subject of many films and books. And so some people know about it through that type of effort. And so it does invoke some fear when people are just starting to see this happen.
And Dr. McLennan, how was it transmitted from person to person?
Yeah. So Ebola is transmitted by very small inocula, in other words, a very small amount of viruses. So, for example, when we think about certain diseases being transmissible, to get salmonella or to get cholera, you need thousands and thousands of bacteria to enter your digestive system. With Ebola, you may need as few as one, maybe 10 virus particles to enter through a mucous membrane or through a small cut. So it's not that it's airborne. It's not that it eats through plastic or anything like that. It is, however, an extremely tiny amount getting to an accessible area of the human body is all that's needed to transmit.
So, Dr. McLennan, so it would take like contact, human contact. I would have to somehow be very in close proximity to someone who has it and then receive it that way. It's not airborne. It's not, if they were touched something and then later I came along and touched something, I wouldn't get it that way?
Not unless what you touched was blood and you had a cut on your hand. I mean, that's really sort of the situation. There are viruses that can survive for a not very long period of time, but some period of time, especially in wet conditions, that may be on a surface and that somebody else could then contact. But this is not something like somebody who's not bleeding, not producing a lot of bodily fluids, not having vomiting, not having diarrhea, just maybe beginning to have symptoms, gets on a bus, travels on a bus, gets off, somebody else travels on the same bus. That is not really a significant risk because that person is not leaving behind bodily fluids that are highly densely contaminated with virus. And again, it doesn't come out in the air. And the exception that we make to that is in a intensive care situation where we are doing procedures that may create aerosols.
So, Rodney Rowdy, tell me about what is happening in the Congo right now. Why are we seeing this incredible number of deaths? We have over 1,500 people who have died so far. What is happening?
Yeah, and you did a great job when you opened up the show kind of talking about this. So as of early August, the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has been reporting about 3,750 confirmed cases. And as you mentioned, they're now reporting it's actually up to 1,700 deaths, close to 1,700 deaths, which is about a 45% case fatality rate, which is, again, something to think about. Ebola does typically have a high case fatality rate as compared to something like, you know, everybody's got COVID on their mind. That was more under 5% fake case vitality rate. So it is a very dangerous disease when it is contacted. And I agree with Dr. McClellan. It's quite often only seen in those who are handling people that may be dying of Ebola. One of the unfortunate things about this outbreak, whether it's this time or other times, is sometimes it's happening to family members or healthcare workers, because those individuals may be handling patients during times where they're highly infectious. We know that in that continent, many African families have rituals where they like to bury their own family members. And so there's some danger in that respect as well. So this outbreak, you know, continues to percolate in that region. We haven't mentioned it yet, but there's no licensed vaccine or really proven antiviral treatment. There is for Ebola a difference. A species of Ebola. This is Bundibugyo. And so right now there's really no proven treatment, although they are doing supportive care and trying some clinical trials of investigational vaccines and therapeutics are underway, but so far nothing has been approved to be used.
And is the social situation there, Rodney Rowdy, even making things more difficult? I've got about a minute here.
Sure. Yeah. The continued community transmission is really being fueled by delayed case detection. There's insecurity, there's armed conflict in the area. Think about the population movement in those areas. There's ongoing shortages of healthcare workers. That includes laboratory workers. And there's really limited access sometimes into these impacted communities. So it's really difficult sometimes when you have that type of situation going on. And we're still dealing, as you mentioned at the start of the show, where the United States has pulled away from some of the primary WHO support and things like that. But we are supporting in a way through logistics, equipment, and other types of things with respect to trying to get that outbreak under control.
Right. So the United States has entered into this emergency now, but it had cut. It dropped out of the World Health Organization. It completely dropped the U.S. AID situation. These were things that may have created the foundation that allowed this outbreak to get established and spread and make it so hard to contain. Our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you have a question or a comment about the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa, concerns about its spreading, concerns that the United States is not really taking a leadership role as we've done in the past, but we'll take your call and we'll answer your questions. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we're going to be talking about possible cuts to AIDS treatment, HIV prevention efforts, and what that might look like here in San Antonio. But right now, we're talking about the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We've had about 1,700 deaths there so far. There are a lot of questions about, what is happening on the ground. Uganda declared its outbreak over in July 28th, but it remains vulnerable to imported cases from the Congo. A lot of problems on the ground in terms of the inability to do contact tracing and questions about distrust of this situation from the general public. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. So Dr. Susan McLennan, let's talk a little bit more about the United States dropping out of the World Health Organization, ending USAID, not really playing the leadership role in this outbreak as it had done in the past. What do you see? What is different with this in regards to this outbreak because of those factors?
Well, it is concerning. I mean, this is an outbreak that was a problem because of where it is in a situation where the social and military and multiple, we're talking 100 and something armed groups operating in that area, and the situation's become worse in the last several years. So already a place where people have a lot of mistrust, certainly have a lot of mistrust of people coming in from other parts of the world and so on. But the United States in the past has been a strong supporter of outbreak response of WHO, with this understanding that the only way to protect America is to make sure that we are part of the response and understand the response and aid the response in endemic countries for diseases that we worry about.
So not just Ebola, but all tropical diseases.
Well, emerging diseases of all types, COVID was one of them. The more we are able to collaborate with people in other parts of the world, the more that we are able to have eyes on what is going on in other parts of the world, the more prepared we are. So, the United States didn't know about this outbreak for days after it was other parts, other individuals that were still associated with WHO were aware. So it does put us on a lower footing. And other responses, such as the requirement to spend 3 weeks in another country if one has been in the DRC prior to returning home, these are problematic. These reduce the ability of those who are part of the response, whether it be through an NGO, whether it be by working with WHO, et cetera, adds 3 weeks to any sort of response. We know from past experience that we are well able to take care of people who become infected in this country and not have any further spread. So we have procedures in place that we used in 2014-15 to take care of individuals, to monitor individuals, and to provide care for individuals who have responded to assist in managing this outbreak. We have the capacity to do that even more so than we did 10 years ago.
Well, you give a very practical answer to why we should be involved with the outbreak, but there's also the moral and ethical reasoning as well.
Oh, we can get into that.
I mean, I think we need to. We're a country of great resources.
Not everybody seems to respond to that. there absolutely is. These are members of our global community. And if we can help, we should try to do so. And there's absolutely, you can talk about the ethical and moral response. But people's, you know, for many people, certainly, you know, well, protecting my own is the most ethical response. And if that neglects protecting others, okay. That, so people, some people consider that to be the ethical response. So getting practical is sometimes a better argument.
I hear all the time that we're a Christian nation, and I think as a Christian nation, you take care of your neighbors, and we should do more to do that. Let's go to a caller, Andy. Andy, thanks for calling in. You're on The Source. Go ahead.
Yes. Some viruses, you can get temporary protection from taking immunoglobulins, for example, gamma globulin for hepatitis. Is there any temporary immunity from this virus with a immunoglobulin?
All right. Thank you for that question, Andy. Rodney Rohde, can you talk about that?
Sure. There are absolutely examples that he mentions where you can take a passive types of antibodies. Sometimes that's the only thing we have. You might remember during COVID, we were actually trying that prior to the vaccinations that were developed. That is sometimes also done when you think of people that might survive an Ebola infection and they develop antibodies. They may actually have multi-year or multi-decade protection, though we have to remember that may be only specific to a particular strain or species of that. There is some monoclonal antibody treatments that are used as therapeutic treatments for active infections rather than as temporary, a kind of prophylactic immunity for healthy individuals. Again, the best types of things we can do is prevent the infections. And so, you know, an ounce of prevention is always better than a pound of cure in most of our minds that work in these types of viral infections. So awareness, education, trying to help individuals in whatever country they live in to try to avoid those infections is really critical as well. I totally agree with Dr. McClellan. We have to take both a practical and a moral type of response to this in my own professional kind of understanding. And I've said this many times publicly, public health measures matter all the time to everyone. That means globally. Being isolationist around diseases is not going to matter when we have diseases that can cross borders. Ebola, SARS, measles, flu, on and on and on, have no bias about what we care about. They don't care how rich we are. They don't care about our culture. They don't care who we vote for. All they care about is infecting you, amplifying, and jumping to the next host. So that global response is really, really critical, because without it, we're sort of flying blind, as Dr. McClellan mentioned. It could put us weeks behind a response here in the United States if we're not at least having open lines of communication with our global partners around the world.
I mean, so we're talking about an Ebola strain for which there's no virus and no effective proven treatment, Rodney. I mean, but are we really worried about Ebola jumping over into the United States? I know there was a case that was on a flight heading from Paris to Detroit, and it was diverted to Montreal, and then they were put back to Europe. But, you know, could Ebola make the jump and become a part, you know, and spread in the United States, you think?
Very, very, very unlikely. Again, going back to what Dr. McClellan talked about, transmission-wise, this virus is primarily going to transmit through body fluids and blood, and really in measures where you're actually getting that type of fluid into a wound or a cut or through some type of surgical procedure. Very unlikely. In fact, I often would tell people during COVID that looking back, right, everything's interesting in retrospect. Back in 2014 and 2015, you might remember how and just terrified, I think, the U.S. Normal citizen was when Ebola showed up on our shores and some of those medical personnel. In reality, Ebola is a little less scary when you have a nation that is going to have processes and procedures surrounding the care of people that might be bleeding or going into the hospital. versus a respiratory agent like COVID. I mean, that the ultimate scare factor is something like SARS-CoV-2 that has a higher mortality rate, and it can spread, you know, rapidly. And if your mortality gets into this 40 to 50 percentile, we're looking at a really big problem of mortality. Ebola is pretty unlikely to establish itself. It is possible for someone to travel to the United States from these areas that are impacted by Ebola, just like anything else.
We had a case at that time in 2015,
right,
in Dallas.
Right. But it's very unlikely that that case would be a ripple effect, where it would become, for example, like an index case and turn into dozens or hundreds of cases. It would be really, really rare. I really don't think that would happen with respect to our medical procedures and education around Ebola.
But we have this outbreak in Africa right now. It's spreading. It doesn't seem like they're able to get a handle on it with 1,700 deaths now. So Dr. McLennan, should we be looking at this and pointing to it and saying we have a collapse of the global public health system and we need to fix this?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a couple of things that I want to go back very quickly to transmission in a place like the United States. People have to recognize that in the countries where things like Ebola spread rapidly, the entire ability to have things like fresh water and water for washing is completely different. We have flush toilets, we have sinks, we have formula 409, we have all kinds of cleaning products that reduce the chance that something that is spread in this way occurs, certainly infant. But if you are taking care of your husband who's come back ill from, let's say, hunting, because that's how the initial cases often happen, and you have no running water, then you're going to be in contact with bodily products for a lot longer and have a much greater chance of getting infected than somebody who is able to wear gloves, wash their hands all the time, et cetera, and so on. So transmission dynamics are profoundly different in a place with very few resources and very low levels of basic sanitation and water accessibility. Now, to go back to the question that you just asked me, because I wanted to make that clear, the transmission dynamics are profoundly different in a high-resource country and a low-resource country. But the question that you asked me was, I'm sorry, you're going to have to help
about
me
about the
that.
Collapse of the global public
yes.
health
well,
system.
This is, well, it's not the global, because there's a lot of the rest of the world that's actually working hard to help.
But when the United States pulled out of USAID, other countries kind of did similar actions. We don't have the U.S. expertise in logistics and moving things around. We don't have the leadership. It means a lot.
Well, you can't rebuild what was taken apart in the last year in just a couple of months, that's for sure. And so...
But we can recognize that what happened was, you know, has caused a lot of suffering, pain, and unnecessary deaths.
Absolutely. I do agree. I so much has been written about that. There's no question that the actions that have dismantled a great deal of public health in the United States are affecting the rest of the world. I am part of more than one project that whose funding was pulled that will reduce our ability to work in other parts of the world, to collaborate with other parts of the world, to provide knowledge and to get knowledge in other parts of the world. As I mentioned, certain policies have made it difficult to respond. I have responded in the past to taking care of Ebola patients, and it's not impossible that I could respond in the future. And my capacity to do so is directly impacted by policies that are being put in place that obstruct our ability to be involved in other parts of the world and to assist in getting an outbreak like this under control. So there's no question that policy decisions that are touted as being protective of the American public, in making a problem greater in the other parts of the world, actually put the American public at greater risk.
All right. I want to thank both of y'all, Dr. Susan McLennan, an infectious disease specialist at UTMB, medical director of the Biocontainment Treatment Unit. Rodney Rowdy, he is PhD, professor and chair of the medical laboratory science at Texas State University. Thank you very much. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.